So I'm so glad to be here, and this is such an interesting question. And we are going to address scientifically, when does life begin? When does a new human being begin? But there are two additional issues that are inextricably bound up into these questions, and I wanted to address those two during this session. And that is the philosophical legal question of, who's a person? And the theological question of, who is my neighbor? How does it impact me and my life? So what I hope to do in this session is to present for about a half an hour and then have about a half an hour or 15 minutes or whenever they cut me off of a very robust discussion, because I want you guys to be thinking of questions, and then I want to hear from you afterwards so that we can talk about this and not just download it, okay? So let's start first with a scientific question. When does a new human being begin? We're going to go on in it, but I want you to note this particular point. There's something that really cool happens, and that is the moment that the sperm penetrates the membrane of the egg. There's zinc channels that close, and they give off a flash of light. Can you believe it? It's just so cool. So this is what happens inside a woman's body. And it's kind of important to understand. It's actually something that I hope everybody, especially the women in this group, will learn by heart, because it's really important to know how your cycle works, how your body works, for all kinds of different reasons. This is one of them. Here are the levels of hormones that the brain makes. It just makes them. You have no control over it. It just makes them. The FSH is what causes the place where the egg is going to form, the follicle, to grow. The LH is what's going to cause the follicle inside the ovary to release an egg. So this is what happens in the ovary. There's little cysts that form, and then one of them gets big enough and matures enough that when it gets this signal from the brain, LH, it pops out, and then the ovary has a place to make the hormone that supports pregnancy, and that hormone that supports pregnancy is called, here you go, ovarian hormone levels, progesterone. Pro meaning for, gest, which is pregnancy, erone meaning steroid hormone. It's real simple if you speak Latin. So progesterone. Estrogen is what causes here inside the uterus, the lining of the uterus to grow, and then progesterone as well to prepare the lining of the uterus for that embryo to implant, because that embryo can't implant at any old point in time. And the lining of the uterus grows and develops in response to the estrogen and progesterone that's made in response to the signals from the brain. It's a beautiful symphony. So your body, women, is a beautiful symphony of all kinds of things happening to allow life to be a place where life can possibly happen. The important thing, though, for this talk is that an embryo forms within 24 hours after egg release. Eggs can only be fertilized for 24 hours, and then they decay and die, and they can't be fertilized. Implantation happens 5 to 7 days after the embryo is created. And the mom misses her period about a week after that. So this is assuming a normal, perfect 28-day cycle. Just so you know, girls, only 5% or 1 out of 20 women have a perfect 28-day cycle. The rest of us normal human beings have cycles that are a little shorter or a little longer. What stays pretty much constant is this ovulation to period. This part of the cycle can vary. So don't get worried if you're not perfect 28 days. Oops. So then that begs a scientific question. In that process, when does a new human being begin? So this is a pillar of salt, okay? And this is what you are if you reduce yourself to just your elements. But are we just our elements? We're not. We're something more than just our elements. And what that more is design. It's organization. So to go from this pillar of salt to this combination of salt requires design. It requires an organizational level, a jump to life. But our question is a being. It's not just a cell. When does a new human being begin? So a being, scientifically, is an organism. And an organism is an individual entity constituted to carry on the activities of life by means of parts or organs, more or less separate in function, but mutually dependent. That is the scientific definition of a living being, of an organism. So in the journey of your life, when did you become an individual constituted to carry on the activities of life by means of parts or organs, more or less separate in function, but mutually dependent, a living being? There's actually a very clear scientific answer to that. The life of a new human being commences at a scientifically well-defined event, the fusion of the plasma membranes of sperm and egg. This conclusion is not a matter of religious belief. It's not a matter of society saying, oh, we're going to decide when a new human being starts. It's a matter of objective scientific observation. This is a very interesting publication, Person's Moral Worth in Embryos. And it's a chapter written by Dr. Maureen Kondik, who is an embryologist, brilliant, internationally known speaker, and a professional colleague. And she says it so well. Throughout science, distinctions between cell types are made based on two criteria, cell composition and cell behavior. So what is this cell made of and how does it act? Based on these criteria, we can confidently say that a new one-celled embryo, the zygote, is formed upon sperm-egg membrane fusion. Why can you say that? Because the zygote has the global integration of tissues into a functional whole. That's the hallmark of a developing organism, and that distinguishes an organism from a cell or a tissue. So at what point do we have that distinction? We have it when you get fusion of sperm and egg cell membranes. Because at that point, the sperm no longer acts as a sperm. The purpose of a sperm is to penetrate an egg. Job done. Sperm's done. The purpose of an egg is to be penetrated. Job's done. At that point, after sperm-egg membrane fusion, no other sperm can get in. The organism, which is the embryo, changes in its function such that it blocks anything else. Embryos exhibit an even more complex level of organization. Embryos are able to coordinate the production of multiple cell types. They coordinate the production of your body. You, as a one-celled embryo, coordinated your body's production in a coherent global pattern directed toward the formation of an integrated, self-sustaining body. At fertilization, two cells fuse to produce a new cell, the zygote. The formation of a new organism is observed throughout the animal kingdom. If you ask any biologist, when does a new monkey start? The answer is sperm-egg fusion. When does a cat start? Sperm-egg fusion. When does a frog start? Sperm-egg fusion. Throughout the animal kingdom, with a few exceptions, that's the way a new animal forms. And in mammals, of which we are, that's the way humans form, sperm-egg fusion. Once the zygote forms, that's the sperm egg, the fused sperm and egg, one cell, it immediately begins developing toward a mature state. It is the same kind of entity across its entire lifespan. Human babies do not mature into baboons or into tumors as a consequence of a normal developmental process. So the events of the first few days of human life, they're initiated by the embryo. The mom doesn't direct this growth. The embryo directs this growth. And the embryo sequentially produces the complex structures and relationships that are required to generate a mature human form. This global organization is you. That's what's continually manifest throughout life, ending only in the death of the organism. What's very, very interesting about this is that you eat food, right? Food becomes you. That carbon, that nitrogen, if you mark that, you won't have the same carbon and nitrogen a year from now. You'll have a different carbon and nitrogen. But what doesn't change is the organization. You are this globally organized entity, which makes use of salt, but is more than salt. This is not to say that organisms can't die. They can change from organism into non-organism. They can die. And if you place an embryo in an environment that supports the cells but not the organismal life, they can die while some of their cells persist as a disordered growth. You can take an embryo and you can turn an embryo into a tumor under the right circumstances. Disease can kill part of the organisms. And disease can also transform them into tumor cells. So you can go from organism, globally integrated, into non-organism. But all of these kinds of transitions are clearly different from an entire living entity, that is an embryo, in a supportive environment. They don't spontaneously turn into a different kind of living thing. They have an intrinsic developmental process. So tumors can produce structures similar to those found in embryos. There's a kind of tumor that can make teeth and hair. But they don't take those structures and integrate them in a temporal sequence that generates functional systems. The tumor never forms an embryo. This tumor just forms teeth and hair and some other things. So the scientific question, when does a new human being begin? First, the embryo is, from the start, distinct from any cell of the mother or father. This is clear because the embryo is growing in her own distinct direction, directed to her own survival and maturation. Second, the embryo is human. She has the genetic makeup characteristic of human beings. And third and most important, the embryo is a complete or whole organism, though immature, fully programmed to use that information, which is intrinsically in herself, to develop herself into a mature human being. So the scientific question, when does a new human being begin, is actually really straightforward. At sperm-egg membrane fusion, which forms a zygote, which is a one-celled human organism, which is a one-celled human being. And if that were all that was at issue, case is closed. But in our society, that is not all what is at issue. What is at issue are two other questions, and we're going to address those, the philosophical legal question and the theological question. We'll start with the philosophical legal question. Who has rights as a person? Who has rights as a person in our society? Well, what's a person? We draw a circle. We draw a circle to say, who are we going to protect as our own? Who deserves our care? Who should be treated with fairness, and who should we protect? And that's what we as people, regardless of your culture, consider as persons. Anything that's outside our circle can be treated as property. So how do we connect human being and person? So I looked up the definition of human being in the medical dictionary. A human being is a human. What a thought. But what's a person? So a person is actually a legal definition. A person is legally defined as the object of legal rights. There are two kinds of legal person. One, human beings, and two, artificial persons such as corporations. We're not going to deal with corporations today. So here we go. We've got human beings and human persons in our circle of protection. But what happens if you take human beings outside of that circle and say, well, we're going to protect persons, but not all human beings are persons? Well, that allows for embryo research. That allows for abortion. That allows for euthanasia. That allows for human trafficking. That allows for slavery. Any condition where you dehumanize, that's the key word. You dehumanize. You say, these are not persons. They may be human beings, but we're not going to treat them. We're not going to protect them. We're not going to treat them fairly. All right, now you say, Harrison, you're exaggerating. This has never happened in our society. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the Dred Scott case, but it's such an important thing for us to understand and remember. Dred Scott was an enslaved African-American man who, along with his wife Harriet, unsuccessfully sued for the freedom of themselves and their two daughters. See, they were slaves brought to Illinois and Wisconsin. Okay. But Illinois and Wisconsin, slavery was illegal. So anyway, this is the Dred Scott versus Sanford case of 1857. The Scotts claimed that they should be granted freedom because Dred had lived in Illinois and Wisconsin for 4 years where slavery was illegal. And the laws in those jurisdictions said that slaveholders gave up their rights to slaves if they stayed for an extended period, and 4 years is an extended period. In this landmark case, the U.S. Supreme Court decided 7-2 against Dred Scott. They found that neither he nor any other person of African ancestry could claim citizenship in the United States, and therefore, on a technicality, Scott could not bring suit in federal court under the diversity of citizenship rules. But what was more interesting is the deliberation. The question of whether or not Dred Scott qualified as a, quote, human being was considered moot by the court. That is, it doesn't matter if he's a human being. The crucial question was whether or not he qualified as a person, that is, a full member of American society. And the court decided that he did not. So here's a human being that's not a human person. And that's what happens when you separate those two. So if we can say what's a human being, well, what in the world's a human person then? Adult human beings are commonly considered persons. And a very interesting question to ask yourself is that of exactly what is it about us that makes us persons? This is from a medical ethics course at University of Missouri. Clearly, it's not having a particular hair color or even having hair or being a particular height or weight or having a brain, etc. The concept of metaphysical personhood would be to use person or personhood as a category of reality. And that would only allow beings of a certain type, okay? Rational, moral agents, etc. But there's no consensus about the criteria. So is it rationality or logical reasoning ability? Well, then toddlers aren't people. Is it consciousness? So if I put you under anesthesia, you're no longer a person? Is it self-consciousness, self-awareness? So if you're not self-conscious all the time, you're not a person? Is it the use of language? What about people that can't speak? Are they not people? Ability to initiate action. What if you have a severing of your spinal cord from your neck down? Can initiate action? Are you not a person? Moral agency and the ability to engage in moral judgments. Now, I don't mean to offend anybody here, but there are some studies which indicate that girls don't achieve normal adult thinking capacity until 21, and boys don't achieve it until 25. So does that make you not a person? Intelligence. How intelligent do you have to be? See, the problem is, does having one or more of these make us a person? Do we have to have all of them? Can we have some minimal set? Does it have to be the same for all persons? Do you see how ridiculous this becomes when you try to decide, well, only these human beings are going to be persons, and all the other human beings I can do whatever I want with? You know where that goes. History's given us this lesson many, many, many times. All of the issues, all the questions of personhood, especially for human beings inside the womb, boil down to four things: size, level of development, environment, and degree of dependency. So here are two human beings. Which one's the person? The bigger one or the smaller one? And how big do you have to be a person? Level of development. Here's a human being and here's a human being, but this human being is more developed than this human being. So is this human being a person and this one isn't? Environment. These two human beings are the exact same gestational age. This is a 26-week-old baby. This is a 26-week-old fetus inside the womb. 4 inches separate them. Does that make one a person and the other not a person? Degree of dependency. Did these two human beings become non-persons because they are now completely dependent on artificial life support? We've tackled the scientific question of when a new human being begins. And we said it's sperm egg fusion. You got a new human being. The philosophical legal question is, are we going to extend to human beings the legal protection of personhood? And who should have rights as a person? Every human being. Anything else is chaos. But that's actually not what our society is fighting about. It's part of it. The other part of it is the theological question. Who do I have to treat as a person? Who is my neighbor? I don't know how many of you guys know and love icons, but I love them. This is a whole story here. So I'm going to share this story with you. On one occasion, an expert in the law stood up to test Jesus. Teacher, he asked, what must I do to inherit eternal life? Well, what's written in the law? He replied. How do you read it? He answered, love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. You've answered correctly, Jesus replied. Do this and you will live. But he wanted to justify himself, and so he asked Jesus, well, who is my neighbor? And in reply, Jesus said, a man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho when he was attacked by robbers. They stripped him of his clothes, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. A priest happened to be going down the same road, and when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. So to a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he traveled, came where the man was, and when he saw him, he took pity on him. He went to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he put the man on his own donkey, brought him to an inn, and took care of him. The next day he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper. Look after him, he said, and when I return, I will reimburse you for any extra expense you may have. Which one of these 3 do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of robbers? The expert in the law replied, the one who had mercy on him. And Jesus told him, go and do likewise. So this is the theological question. Who is my neighbor? What did Jesus do in this parable? He put our vulnerable human being neighbor back into the circle of our care and protection and made our neighbor those human beings who God puts into our lives. Now, you didn't choose your parents. You didn't choose your siblings. You didn't choose your classmates. God puts lots of human being neighbors into our lives that we didn't choose. It's what we call unchosen obligations. But that doesn't mean they're not our neighbors just because we didn't choose to have them be our neighbors. It was God's choice, not our choice, as to who our neighbor is. So in this parable, what did Jesus say we are to do? We're to love our neighbor as we love ourselves. Not just the neighbors we choose, but the neighbors we don't choose, the ones he puts in our life. Love does no harm to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law. This is the question that we as sinful human beings most want to avoid answering. Why? It requires something of us that we don't want to give. But as Lutherans, we must answer. Consider your place in life according to the 10 Commandments. Are you a father or a mother? There is a biological reality that happens when the sperm meets the egg. The person whose body the sperm came from becomes at that instant a father. The person whose egg that body came from becomes at that instant a mother. There's only 2 possibilities from that point on. You will either be the mother of a living child or the mother of a dead child. You'll either be the father of a living child or the father of a dead child. That's reality. I know, well, I don't know, but I suspect some of you have had this really tough situation. Okay, I have an unchosen neighbor who's now in my womb. What am I going to do? And some of you have said, I don't care. I'm not going to carry this unchosen neighbor, and have allowed that neighbor to be killed and removed. Guys, there is hope and forgiveness. Hope and healing doesn't come from denying reality. Hope and healing comes from admitting reality. See your pastor, talk. Confession and absolution, that's what it's there for. God has made a way for you to come back to Him and be at peace with Him. And take advantage of that means by which we can come back to God and be at peace with Him. He will forgive you. That's what He does. He's mercy. When that new human being is created in their mother's womb, that human being is created into a world of relationships. That girl or boy in the womb is a son or daughter, a grandson, a granddaughter, a brother or sister. That human being in the womb has a father and a mother. That's reality. We can, by the power of God's word and spirit, do the actions which show God's love to every neighbor He puts into our lives, even the most difficult, even the most unchosen, even at the wrong time and place. We can still love that neighbor and allow God's work of love in our life. Our life, our actions, and our love, it matters to God. It matters now, and it matters eternally. I'd be glad to take any questions. Yes, go ahead.
What do you see as some of the most extreme consequences of rejection of executive sexual service? Let's be talking about everywhere, so you can relate to that a little bit more.
Okay. I have to repeat the question because they're recording the session. So the question is, what is the most extreme consequence of rejecting this view of life? Well, I think personally what happens to the woman who says, I don't want this human being, is that she's at increased risk of suicide, drug abuse, depression, should increase risk of never having another child. We know that statistically, if you abort your first baby, you know, we look by looking at lots and lots of health records, if you abort a first baby, 1/3 of those women who abort the first baby never have any more children. Now, that could be because they can't, or that could be because it's too painful, psychologically too, lots of reasons, but that first baby is it's a bifurcation. It's a decision point. Okay. And it takes your life in a certain direction. And that's a huge consequence. Societally, if we say it's okay to kill the human beings that we don't want, man, look at Germany. Look at Stalinist Russia. Look at the genocides that are going on in some countries in Africa. I mean, we've done this experiment as societies. The moment you say there's some human beings that are non-persons, you can do whatever you want with those non-persons. It's a sheer raw power issue. And that's ugly. That's a really ugly society. That is not one that will tolerate Christians for very long, because we are a thorn in the side. Does that answer the question? Yeah.
How do we care for mothers who have children to have abortion? As a church, how do we come together and care for their well-being?
For the moms who have had abortions?
Who have made that choice. Yeah. We've had discussions. I'm a youth leader that we have generations in our church, and there's people that are really pro-life, and they'll say things
right
that they don't mean it to be, but if another young adult hears that, obviously this is no longer safe. Place to heal.
Yeah.
So how do we as a church body make it a safe place? Obviously, we are against extinguishing a human being.
Right.
And a human life, and we believe that the sanctity of life. But we're also all sinners. And so we come into an environment. I know for me personally, I've called it out when we've been in a mixed women's group and somebody says something.
Yeah.
And it's usually a political slant to things.
Yeah.
I've said, hey, you don't know we don't know everybody's history. Let's be careful with our language. But how else can we, as a whole, talk about that?
Well, I think an opinion, okay? I've been in medicine for 30 years, OB-GYN. I have never, ever, ever met a woman who got pregnant in order to have an abortion. Ever. Okay. What happens is this plan that God put in place that there would be two human beings becoming one flesh was meant to be a lifelong plan. Okay. She was never, ever, ever meant to have a baby by herself. So you got this initial abandonment. Okay. Initial abandonment, sometimes by the father. Okay. And then the next layer of protection that is supposed to be around is the extended family. And if the extended family says, sweetheart, you're not going to dishonor our name, you know, I'm driving you to the abortion clinic, or like the woman in, I believe it was Texas, where the mom bought the abortion pill and gave it to her, even though she didn't want an abortion. Okay, so you got layers of breakdown of the protection that moms put around it. So for the woman who's experienced those layers of breakdown of protection, they're vulnerable. It's going to take a very safe place for them to open up for a second, maybe 2 seconds, maybe 4 seconds. So can you create in your church a safe place? Now, I am a big on pastoral authority, but I will tell you it is extremely, extremely, extremely unlikely for a woman who's had an abortion to go to a male pastor and say it. So what that means is we need females in the congregation who can, number one, keep their mouth shut. Number two, understand what's going on with this situation. This is not an evil person. This is there's a famous, oh man, I can't remember her name, famous lawyer who said, women choose abortion like a rabbit caught in a trap, choose their leg off. Okay? It's not the choice of a hard-hearted person. It's a choice of a hurting, desperate person. So, and you got to have a woman who understands, maybe has been through it herself, maybe has had, but understands, has a heart of compassion to say, honey, I love you. What you did is not, it's part of the destruction of your life. And we're going to be here to surround you with things that bring you back to health and healing, okay? In your time, in your way, but we're here to support you. That's not a congregation-wide discussion. That is a one-on-one, one-on-two, one-on-three for those moments that opportunities open to even be able to influence. Does that make sense?
Yeah. But okay. I think that there's a larger discussion within our church body as to how we're talking about the sanctity of life. How we're talking about the political pieces. I live in Minnesota.
Okay.
So we have a very awful abortion law in our state.
And I'm from Michigan. I feel your pain.
So, but what I find as a younger woman in our church, I'm kind of middle age, so I'm right in the middle.
Yeah.
And where we're losing because of all of the rhetoric from outside is that topic, that biblical hold on. Like, we have to leave that at the door and come into Christ as the hospital that we are, as the church is being a hospital that we are, and we're all here to be healed. I guess my point is, I think we need to talk about that piece of the hurting. Like, instead of villainizing the woman or shaming the woman, because often we need to be talking about all of that. Catching on the mob, the layers, the lifelong. I mean, we need to be talking in those terms and not as, oh, abortion is awful. Yes, it is awful. But you say that in the presence of somebody who's had an abortion.
Yeah.
Now this is no longer a safe space.
Well,
if that makes sense.
I'm not big into safe spaces, but I'm big into healing spaces.
Yeah.
And I think you're right. We gotta be extremely careful. Because these are very hurting, very vulnerable people. I'll give you a great example. I gave a lecture on abortion to a church, okay, a long time ago. And a woman came up afterward and she said, you have no idea what you're talking about. You are wrong. And it went on, you know, and I stood there and she said, because I talked about complications of abortion. She said, nobody ever told me this before I had my abortion. Nobody ever told me I'd never be able to have kids. Nobody. And she's dissolving in tears. And the anger is from such deep hurt. I just hugged her. And I told her I was really sorry and that there's healing. You know, but understand, anger is a response to deep hurt. Okay, so you got deep hurt and you got deep hurt all around. You got guys that couldn't do anything to stop their girlfriend or wife from getting an abortion. What is that like, you know, to carry that burden? There's all of us, many of us in the room are carrying deep, deep, deep hurts. And you're right, the church has to be a place where we can actually share those deep hurts without making the deep hurts worse. And you're right, rhetoric, you know, knee-jerk doesn't help. I'm not going to open myself up to be punched if somebody's punching, you know? So how do we create those safe spaces? And I would really say to you, I don't think it's going to happen in a big congregation. I think it's got to happen in very, very tiny, very, very tiny relationships, but relationships that are informed with the fact that this is deep hurt, but there is healing. There is healing that comes from this. I mean, it's not like abortion is the only sin that ravages our lives. You know, there are people that, you know, have had unfaithfulness in their spouse. You know, if we admit we have stuff that rip us apart as human beings, how can we make the church a place where instead of being ripped apart further, we're put back together again. So I'm so glad. I'm so glad you brought that up. It's so super important. Politics is not the way. Yeah, go ahead.
For the woman who didn't have an abortion, what resources do they have in the Lutheran Church, you know, if they decided to keep the baby but she needed help?
That is going to vary on a congregation-by-congregation basis and how many pregnancy care centers are around. How integrated is that church with other support systems? So, for example, I mean, the ideal, the absolute ideal would be that there's an integrated medical community to care for that woman because her delivery is going to look a little different. Not physically, it's going to be the same physical delivery, but, you know, socially it's going to look a little different, that there would be educational and teaching resources for her, that there would be job opportunities for her, that you know, that there would be stuff that would allow her to flourish, human flourishing as a family. So again, it's going to vary church by church. Some churches have nothing. Some churches have a lot, but it would be great if all of us, you know, would be thinking about, okay, what does a mom need to flourish and for her kids to flourish? And then how can we provide that in our community? Great question. Yeah.
I would just tack onto that downstairs in the exhibit hall if there's a life minute down. That would be the good place to start as far as that goes. And then my question would be, in light of the signs that you showed us in the beginning, what do we need to understand that would be different in an IVF situation? What are we doing in that lab? Is that life we're creating?
Well, it's an outstanding question. Are there embryos, human embryos being created? Absolutely. Is it ever possible to do IVF without causing damage or death to the human beings being created? Maybe. The hugest problem with IVF, money. It's money. Okay, so if you retrieve one egg, only one out of three eggs that are retrieved are fertilized. Okay, so, and every cycle of IVF is $30,000 to $50,000. Okay, so let's start adding it up. You retrieve three eggs, one fertilized, you put that embryo back in the womb, and only one out of three ever implant. Okay, well, what if I retrieve nine eggs and three fertilized and I put all three back in and one would take? Well, what happens if all three take? Okay, what happens if I have a less fertilization rate? Well, what if I retrieve 12, and I have to do this all again. What if I retrieve 12 or 20 eggs? Then I can take the best three, put them back in, and freeze the rest so they're in the freezer. So if I want to do this again, I can just pull them out of the freezer. It's money. So the thing is, right now, the IVF industry is completely unregulated. Any IVF doctor can do whatever the heck they want, okay? And the financial incentive for not going through multiple cycles of IVF is huge. What do you do about that? Can you talk to your doctor about retrieving one egg and fertilizing that egg? Natural cycle IVF. You can. Just know that every time you do that, you've got 30% chance of success, and it's $30,000 to $50,000. So by the time you ever get there, you're talking $150,000, $200,000, $300,000. Do you see what I mean with the problem? So it's more complicated than just saying, don't do IVF. Maybe it's possible. And you have to know, self-disclosure, I'm on the board of the National Embryo Donation Center. Okay, this is where people who have frozen embryos who don't want to kill them or reimplant them donate for somebody else who wants to adopt a baby and start that adoption in the womb. All right? I'm not against this technology. I would say that the way the industry is right now, it could care less whether or not these embryos are human beings. And there have been several court decisions that my organization have been involved in, and we have argued that when there's a legal case, there's been several legal cases where the one spouse wants the embryos implanted somewhere. The other spouse wants the embryos thawed and destroyed. They go to court. We have argued that the disposition of the embryos should be according to family law. Best circumstances for the embryos. That's family law disposition. We've lost because the court said this is being decided according to property law. These embryos are property. So there's many places where this person versus property expresses itself in our society. Does that answer your question? Okay.
I'm curious how you would go about, or how you would recommend going about talking to people who are pro-choice, started that conversation with someone and maybe looking to change their mind or just even plant the seed and hey, this is my viewpoint.
After 25 years of exhibiting at conferences that are pro-choice, okay, very hostile conferences, I generally start out with this. You're pro-choice, I'm pro-informed choice, okay? So why don't you show me all the papers that you have, scientific papers, that show that aborting a woman under these circumstances produces great long-term results? And I'll show you 170 studies that show that aborting a woman produces an increased risk of extremely preterm birth and subsequent wanted pregnancies. And the studies, I think there's 70, around 70, 60 or 70 studies, would show that a woman who chooses abortion is at increased risk of suicide, drug abuse, and hospitalizable major depression. And the studies would show that women who abort a first pregnancy and then delay or never have children are at increased risk of breast cancer because they never matured their breast to lactation. And breast tissue that was never matured to lactation, that's where 99% of cancers arise from. It takes taking a pregnancy past 20 weeks in order for that breast tissue to start becoming cancer resistant. And when you get a breast to term, 95% of that breast tissue is permanently cancer resistant. That's why, unarguably, this isn't controversial. The single most important factor as to your breast cancer risk is age at first pregnancy, age at first term pregnancy. So usually when I say that, there's crickets. Because that's just the way it is. Okay, if we're talking about empowering women, this is not empowering women because women aren't being told this. This is denial of informed choice. So if we want to talk about choice, let's talk about informed choice. And that's how I would start. But depends on the relationship, you know. Go ahead. Yeah, that's a great question. We had that in the last session too. So there are situations, they're not common. There are situations where continuing to be united, for the mom and baby to be united in pregnancy is life-threatening to the mom. Most of those situations, we're talking 90%+ of those situations, happen after 20 weeks, after the point where the baby can survive the separation from the mom. So in those cases, you just separate the baby and the mom. Under circumstances where the baby can maximize its chances of his or her chances of survival, and the mom can maximize his or her chances of survival. Okay? So the ethical issue doesn't exist when the baby can survive outside the womb. Are there situations where the baby can't survive outside the womb and continuing the pregnancy will threaten the life of the mom? Yep, there are. They're not very common. Most of the diseases that happen, happen, you know, in the second, after the baby, after viability. But there are circumstances, and all of us as OB-GYNs have faced them. One of them is an ectopic pregnancy. You saw that embryo rolling happily down the fallopian tube into the womb. Sometimes the embryo implants in the fallopian tube. It's called an ectopic pregnancy. In those circumstances, 93% of the time, the embryo's body never forms because of whatever reason. It doesn't form. So by ultrasound, you don't see an embryo, even though by this time in gestation, you should. In those cases, there's no ethical issue. But in 7% of the cases, there's an embryo with a heartbeat. And so now you have it. Embryo with a heartbeat. And here's your choices as an OB-GYN. You can separate that mom and that human being, knowing that that human being is going to die. Nobody lives at 6 weeks or 12 weeks outside the womb, 6 weeks gestation. Or you cannot, and they'll both die. In either case, the embryo is going to die. It's a question of, can you intervene in a way to save the mom's life? And that's covered under, if you guys are philosophical, ethical types, under what's called the principle of double effect. And that's when you have an action that is good, that is saving the mother's life. You have an unintended consequence, which is baby's going to die. No way around it. But the mom's life isn't saved by the baby dying. Okay? If I go in and kill that baby, that's not going to save the mom's life. She has to be separated from the baby and the placenta. Okay? So what you're doing is separating the mom and the baby. You're not intentionally killing the baby. Okay? Even though we know 100% baby's going to die. Why is that important, that distinction? Because in an abortion, as we commonly understand abortion, the purpose of an abortion is to produce a dead baby. That's the purpose. In the partial birth abortion hearings, which probably predate you guys, the abortionists were asked, look, you got the baby's body delivered out and there's only the head left in the womb. Why are you sucking the brains out? And the answer from the abortionists was, the product we are paid to produce is a dead baby. And that's why when there's an abortion at 32 weeks or any time after the baby can survive and the baby lives, the separation didn't fail to happen, guys. What failed to happen is the baby failed to die. That's why it's a failed abortion. So you have to be really clear about what an abortion is and what it isn't. These separations to save the mom's life, they're not abortions because the purpose of the separation is to save the mom's life. It's not to produce a dead baby. So I hope that helps to answer your question. Does that make sense? Okay, go ahead.
How do you refute the claim that it's like the mom's fault?
That's what it says.
Okay, well, my bodily autonomy ends where your nose begins, okay? So I can't go up, even if I feel like it, and whap you in the face because even though I have bodily autonomy, I can't use my bodily autonomy to hurt somebody else's body. And it's ludicrous. It's ludicrous to claim that the baby's body is the mom's body. It's a different heartbeat, different sex, different genetic makeup. That's a different person. Okay. Now you may say, I'm sorry. That's a different human being. You may say, not a person, property. I don't care. Getting rid of this property, evicting, you know. But the fact is, it is a human being. And my bodily autonomy ends where that human being's body begins. That's how I would answer. Yes, you've been waiting a little while.
What do you think the solution is for this? Would you suggest making abortion illegal? Because the argument that I hear all is wrong is,
yeah.
Well, if it's made illegal, then women will keep doing it, but but it will only hurt themselves, and it will be like really bad.
Well, they're already hurting themselves. This whole do-it-yourself abortion is horrendous. Let's look at countries where abortion has been made illegal. You know, the argument is, oh, women are going to die in the streets if you make it illegal. Well, it was made illegal in Chile. There was a time when abortion was legal. It was made illegal. And what happened to the maternal death rate? It plummeted. What happened to the abortion-related death rate? It plummeted because abortions were less common. Okay. So right now you got 1 out of 3 babies being aborted. That's horrendous. And you have no collection at all. No tracking of who's dying from this. It's abysmal. So I would say, show me the evidence that making abortion illegal increases maternal mortality. There isn't, but there's lots of evidence that it actually causes less women to die when you make it illegal. Yeah, go ahead. Both of you. You first, ladies first, and then you.
The question is, what do they do when someone is defended but not by choice?
Yeah. Well, if you look at women who've been raped, okay, half the women who've been raped keep their babies. It's not like I'm raped is an automatic indication for an abortion. In fact, what do we know about mental health of women who abort? It's another trauma. So you've got a woman who's raped. It's horribly traumatic. Don't get me wrong. I am no friend of rapists, all right? I personally can think of lots of things that I would like to do with them. But does aborting her baby make her unraped? It doesn't. It adds another trauma on top of an already traumatic situation. And this is the thing. You would think that there would be like huge evidence that aborting a woman who's been raped causes an improvement in her mental health. There actually isn't that. Okay, 2 minutes. There actually isn't that evidence. So I would say to you, before we add another trauma onto this horrifically traumatic thing that happened to her, maybe we ought to look at the consequences of that. And I would not. Now, she's legally able to get an abortion if she wants it. But if she were my patient, I'd say, honey, I want to support you to the thing that's going to bring you ultimately to the best health and healing in this horrible situation. And in my experience, it's give life to this person who's innocent. They didn't do anything to you. And then if you choose to, you know, raise this baby, if you choose not to raise it, I'll support you through whatever you choose. But I'd encourage you not to add a trauma on a trauma. Go ahead.
So she actually said first person I had asked.
So, oh, okay.
The other question I had was to tack on to the her body, her choice thing is that how would you solve like the things violinist problem where
I'm sorry. Well, first of all, the famous violinist is not reality. Okay. And having another human being in your womb is a common reality. So I think ethicists love this, you know, how many angels are dancing on the head of the pin stuff. It's irrelevant. What's relevant is here's a human being who's a mom, who has another human being, her child, inside her womb. What are we going to do? You know, what's going to bring the best health and healing in this situation where she's doesn't want this person right now? It's another one of those, how do you help people who have to love their neighbor in unchosen obligations?